Miracle on the Hudson or Pilot Skill? An interview with U.S. Airways First Officer Jeff Skiles by Dave Wyman, editor and publisher of Midwest Flyer magazine. On January 15, 2009, U.S. Airways Captain Chelsea B. Sully Sullenberger of Danville, California, and First Officer Jeff Skiles of Oregon, Wisconsin, successfully landed an Airbus 320 without power in the Hudson River. The aircraft was November 106 U.S. flight number 1549. The event received international attention and much more attention than the crew felt it deserved. Yet the incident was positive for aviation and positive for Americans during a period of time which lacked good news. Shortly after departing New York LaGuardia International Airport on a flight to Charlotte, North Carolina, at an altitude of 3,200 feet, the Airbus 320 hit a flock of geese, causing both engines to shut down. The events that followed have been called a miracle by the news media and general public. The crew and fellow pilots believe that pilot skill and experience played a more important role in reaching a happy outcome. Too low to return to LaGuardia or to land at nearby Teterboro Airport, Captain Sullenberger made the command decision to land in the Hudson River, and all 155 passengers and crew were rescued without serious injury. On February 20, 2009, I had the opportunity to sit down with U.S. Airways First Officer Jeff Skiles and hear firsthand about his experience. The following is that interview. Jeff Skiles, welcome home to Oregon, Wisconsin, which is coincidentally the home of Midwest Flyer magazine since 1978. And anyhow, welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's good to be here.
I bet it is. Good to be anywhere.
That's true, I suppose.
Hey, Jeff, before we get into doing a play-by-play description of what happened that day, tell us about yourself, where you grew up, where you learned to fly, a little bit about your family.
Well, I grew up in a suburb of Madison, Wisconsin, here in Monona, Wisconsin, and both of my parents were actually pilots, private pilots. My father was a professor at the university here, but he got his pilot's license at probably in the 1960s sometime, and my mother in the 1970s. I learned how to fly when I was, 16 or 17 at one of the FBOs here in Madison, Wisconsin.
Okay, very good. Kind of think about it, I may have met your father before. That's interesting. Was he a member of the University of Wisconsin Flying Club?
Actually, I don't believe he ever was, no, because he owned a Tri-Pacer and then a Cessna 182 himself for most of the time he was flying.
And did he base the airplane here at Madison?
Yes, he did.
What motivated you to become a pilot? I mean, obviously, the influence of your father probably played a great role in that.
Oh, definitely. I guess I never really considered doing anything else, probably, from when I was 5 years old. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, I don't think there was a type airplane that I couldn't identify. Now, of course, it's changed so much that I don't recognize most of the things out there on the ramp.
How old were you when your dad let you take the controls and maybe even make your first landing?
I don't remember him ever letting me make a landing, but he wasn't a flight instructor. So I'm sure it was when I was 16 or 17 before I got to do that.
Who was your first flight instructor here in the Madison area? Let's give him a little recognition. Jeff, you know, we all have our idols in life, and as fellow pilots, we have people that we admire. Who do you feel inspired you the most to become a pilot?
Well, I suppose I'd have to say my father, because I was flying in his Tri-Pacer from my earliest memory, I suppose.
Very good. And was he a private pilot or a commercial pilot or what?
Well, he had a commercial pilot's license, but he was a college professor, so he never actually flew professionally.
Okay, very good. What kind of, outside of flying with your dad, what other general aviation experience do you have?
Well, I mean, obviously, my background is all general aviation. Learned to fly, pumping gas at the airport as a line attendant, became a flight instructor, and then I flew for a cargo airline for a while, and then also for a commuter here in Wisconsin for a short while before getting hired by U.S. Airways.
What commuter airline was that?
Mid-State Airlines. They've been gone for 20 years now.
Yeah, they have Metroliners, don't they?
Yep, I flew the Metroliner.
Yeah, I got to fly one of those once, and it was a kick. We were on a FAA check ride, and I have the chief pilot with us. And, what was the name of that chief pilot?
Oh, at Midstate? I don't remember. He's actually... He actually worked at U.S. Airways for a while, and then he died of a brain embolism some time ago. Mm. I mean, probably now 10 to 15 years ago.
Okay. Anyhow, yeah, great memorable experiences. Hey, you're telling me you have glider experience, and I think this is really pertinent in the case with U.S. Airways flying that Airbus 320 without any power. Tell us about your experience as a glider pilot.
Well, I mean, boy, I'm going back 30 years now, but I did some gliding up at South Bend, and in fact, my instructor up there was a former Luftwaffe pilot, and they back before they actually had powered airplanes in World War II, they started out with gliders, and he was part of that group, so he was actually in the Luftwaffe for all of the 1930s, and. He's not around anymore, but and he was my instructor up there at South Bend, and then I transferred down to Maury Field here in Madison because he had a Blahnik glider, which was a Czechoslovakian glider, and I flew that for a while.
Okay, very good. It's interesting that you mentioned the German pilot that you flew with over at South Bend, because some of the great air show performers of today, Oscar Bosch, he was a German fighter pilot and a Nazi. And Manfred Radius up in Toronto. In fact, both Oscar and Manfred live in Toronto, and they're superb aerobatic sailplane pilots. And that's interesting. Do you feel your experience as a glider pilot helped you in this incident?
No, not really, no. I mean, we were just stretching the glide as long as we could, with no engines.
Okay, well, that's what you do with a glider. You have no engines, but you have no, in a case with the Airbus, you're really, and unlike a sailplane, you don't have any lift at all, do you? Or does it? Tell me about that. What's the relationship between the lift of a glider and the lift that you would get in an Airbus 320?
Well, I mean, if you've ever flown a glider, you have a surprising amount of control, more so than you would think you would just from flying powered planes, just because they sail for so long. And, of course, you have the spoilers, and once you pull those up, they drop like a rock. So you have a lot of control over your pattern when you're coming around to land. More so than you'd realize if you never flew a glider. Obviously, in this case, we were just flying at what we call green dot, which is our best lift over drag speed, and it was probably giving us about 1,000 foot per minute descent without any engines. But we were just going as far as we could, trying to restart the engines. And where we wound up was, that was just where we ran into the ground.
No, in the water.
Well, yeah, the water.
All right. Hey, Jeff, let's talk about the flight more. I mean, we're starting to get into it, and I like you to take your fellow pilots on the flight with you from engine startup at LaGuardia to the moment that the engines failed, and the events following the landing.
Well, this was the very last leg of a four-day trip for us, so we were going to fly from LaGuardia to Charlotte, and we were going to be done, and I was going to catch a flight to Chicago and the bus up to Madison to go home. And I was, uneventful up until that point. We started up, we taxied out, there wasn't a lot of traffic. We took off on runway 4 in LaGuardia, and they gave us an initial heading of 360 after takeoff. So I was flying. So it's just normal procedures up until that point. The Airbus actually flies with a side stick. It doesn't use a yoke. And this is something totally new in my experience. I've never flown with anything that didn't have a yoke before. So I only had, 35 hours in the airplane. And most of the time, I mean, the vast majority of the time was on autopilot, because they actually encourage you to use the autopilot as much as possible. I mean, ideally, they want you to take off, put it on at 100 feet, and not take it off until you're on short final. But I was hand flying it because I still wasn't really used to this side stick very much. So I was using every opportunity to hand fly it that I could. And on this particular departure, it wasn't a nav departure, as we call it, which means it's programmed into our computers, and in that case you have to put it on autopilot just to fly it. This was just a straight heading and altitude, so I was hand flying the airplane. So we took off, we cleaned up, turned to 360 degree heading, and I believe they gave us a heading that was even further to the left, and about 3,000 feet, I looked up. And out the windshield, I suddenly saw a line of birds, and I always felt they were Canada geese just because they were flying all in a line the way Canada geese fly. And initially, of course, they looked like we were gonna hit them. And then our nose was up for the climb, and I saw the birds actually descending in my windshield, just like you judge an approach, to landing. And I thought, oh, good. They're going to go underneath us. And, well, they went underneath the windshield, but they impacted on the wings and the engine. And I remember hearing about four thuds. And within moments after that, the right engine went to idle, and then followed by the left engine very closely after that. And, of course, for both of us, this is just, this is not something you're prepared for. It's not something you've trained for. To have a dual engine failure at low altitude is, very unexpected. At that point, Captain Sullenberger said, my aircraft, which is our normal, that's our normal terminology for it, and turned the ignition on, and I started working on what we call a dual engine failure checklist, which is it's a physical checklist in our what we call a quick reference handbook, QRH. So first of all, I had to find it. Because our QRH is about 105 pages, but fortunately I'd just been out of training, so I knew exactly what the procedures were and what to do. And Captain Sullenberger just started making a gentle turn to the south, and I think we're both thinking the only place that was open was that river. And while we're evaluating things, I started running the checklist. He declared an emergency, and they cleared us for landing. Back in LaGuardia, and I briefly asked him, what about 1-3, landing on 1-3, and it was on his side of the airplane, so I could not see LaGuardia, and he said, we can't make it, and he told that to the control tower, and then they said, what about Teterboro, and I kind of paused what I was doing in my procedure and looked out at Teterboro myself.
Which was in which direction?
That would have been on my side of the airplane, kind of off in the distance, and, when you had that river there, flying over a bunch of houses and buildings to get to Teterboro didn't look like all that viable a possibility. It'd be one of those things, it was impossible to judge at that point whether you could make it or whether you couldn't. And certainly at least doing it that fast. And I remember thinking, geez, I don't know about that, and that doesn't look good to me. And then Sully told the controllers that, nope, we're not making it, we're going into the Hudson. I thought, great, that looks like the best possibility to me, and I went back to doing what I was doing, which was trying to restart the engines at that point. And obviously that didn't happen. And for me, it was almost disbelief the whole time. I kept thinking, this can't be happening. These engines are going to restart. It's going to happen. When these engines are going to start, we're going to fly back and we're going to land in an airport. But obviously that didn't happen. And
let me ask you, were you feeling anxious at that time, a little concerned, you thought the engines were going to restart, so you were still, at that point, still pretty calm?
Well, having something to do, helps you to fight down that, that fright instinct. Like, it really wasn't that bad for us, because, we knew what we were going to do. I could imagine where people in the back, particularly the flight attendants, because they had to know what the score was here. Mm-hmm. They had nothing to do but sit there and think about it and not know what was happening. Mm-hmm. In talking to the passengers, because I met quite a few of them, they didn't really know what was going on. Most of them thought they lost the engine on their side of the airplane, but that we were returning to land in LaGuardia. And even right until we came in and landed on the water. Of course, LaGuardia is surrounded by water on, you know, three sides. So the fact that you're looking out and you're at low altitude and you still see water out there, that's not a surprise for anybody that's familiar with LaGuardia. So pretty much for everybody in the back, until they got the brace for impact, you know, announcement, they thought this was just a normal, you know, return to field and land.
At what point did you give up trying to restart the engines, or did you keep trying until you touched down on the water?
Oh, I think it was probably just a couple hundred feet in the air. I realized, well, this isn't going to happen.
And at that point, Jeff, is there a procedure? I'm sorry, I'm not an airline pilot, so I don't know this stuff. But that you have to officially shut down? I mean, the engines were shut down, but do you shut the fuel off going to the engines to avoid a fire, or what do you do in that case? Once you decide, hey, I can't start these engines?
Actually, they were running, both of them. I saw the Airbus memo. The left one was running at about idle power. The right one was running at something less than. In fact, I don't even know the right one was running. I know the flight attendant said that they could hear the ticking of the turbine blades, the fan blades going around like they do when you're sitting on the ramp and they're not powered. It'll make a tick, 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 tick sound as the wind is turning the fan blades, and they said they could hear that. But supposedly the left one was actually given about 30% N1 or 35% N1. The right one was only about 15%, so that one was probably completely shut down. I forgot the question.
The question was, how do you shut the fuel off going to the engines to avoid a fire?
We don't do that prior to the actual landing, no, but then after we actually landed on the water, I did an evacuation checklist, and part of that is pushing our fire buttons, which is preparatory to putting out a fire if you had an engine fire, and what that does is it shuts off everything to the engines. It shuts off the fuel, you know, the hydraulics, electrics, everything to the engines.
Okay, you never did have a fire on the engines at all, did you?
No, but using those buttons even without a fire is the normal procedure because it shuts, with one push of a button, it shuts down everything.
Okay, and I was glad that you just, I'm sure you were too, you just got out of training and you knew what chapter to go to in this thick checklist book, but how much of your checklist was done by memory, and is there an emergency memory checklist procedure that you follow, or you go strictly to the paper?
Actually, you know, in the airline industry, they've tried to get away from memorized checklists and go to these QRH procedures. There's only two things that we actually even have memory items on in the Airbus, and they're minimal, just a couple items, because they want us to use an actual physical checklist as opposed to parroting things from memory, which was the way it was when I was first hired.
Tell me what it felt like when you're touching down on the Hudson River. How did it feel? A lot of this was covered in newspaper articles and in some of your interviews, but how did it feel, and did it feel different than landing on a hard surface runway?
Well,
and do you have a seaplane rating?
I don't have a seaplane rating, but, you know, surprisingly, it wasn't that bad. You know, I understand in the back of the cabin it was bad, but up in the cockpit we just kind of skipped on the runway, and then it just sort of settled in, and water came over the windshield, but I was thrown forward against my shoulder harnesses, but not particularly violently. I just remember moving forward, but you know, it wasn't like I had any bruises or anything from the shoulder harnesses, and I'm sure it wasn't even close to being that bad. And then the airplane just kind of bobbed back up, and as you probably saw from the pictures, the cockpit in particular was way up out of the water, and it was just seemed to be floating there and perfectly stable and like a boat.
As it should be, right?
Yeah. I mean, everybody was surprised that it floats, even Airbus. You know, I mean, nobody's ever done this before.
Now describe after the airplane's come to a rest. Tell me, you know, what happened from that point on, what you did. And in fact, before we go there, I do want to ask you, did you brace for impact? And how do you brace as a crew of an airliner for impact if you do?
No, we don't do that, but we have 5-point shoulder harnesses up on our seats, you know, which obviously the people in the back just have a standard, like a car kind of seat belt. So we don't have any procedure to actually brace for an impact.
Okay, so thank you for answering that. Okay, now the airplanes come to a halt, and what do you and Sully do? What's the first thing you guys do?
Well, Sully has to command an evacuation, and we don't have any electrical power at that point. So he had to open the door and say evacuate. I was doing an evacuation checklist for a while afterwards. So by the time I actually left the cockpit, half the passengers had already left the airplane. So they were enthusiastic about getting off the airplane. And, you know, as you saw from the pictures, a number of them just threw the emergency exit doors out and walked out on the wings. And then we had the actual escape slides on the front of the airplane are also rafts. All of U.S. Air flies three different types of Airbuses, three different models. And the 320 is the only one that's certified for extended over water, which means you can be 400 miles offshore. And the escape slides are double as rafts on those airplanes. They don't on the 319s and the 321s. So it was the ideal airplane for this to happen in, from that perspective. But I went back there, and you know, the passengers were getting off the airplane just fine, but they weren't taking any life vests with them because they're underneath the seats. And of course, nobody was paying attention when the flight attendants were going through their announcements to know that that's where they were. So I was in the back of the cabin, you know, getting life vests and the seat cushions, and tossing them out to the people on the wings so that they could put them on. And I did that for some period of time. I don't really know how long. And after a while, there was nobody left in the airplane, and I was still doing it. And then Sully came by, and we're the only people left. We'd been the only people left for a while, so he says, let's get out of here. And we did.
How far back, you know, I understand from the one flight attendant that was way in the back of the airplane, because one passenger tried to get out the rear exit door, that there was water coming in, and there was quite a bit of water when she left. How many feet of water was there, and did you and Sully walk, and I heard you guys walked up and down the line, but how far back did you go? Did you go all the way back to the tail?
I didn't know. I went back, you know, probably two-thirds of the way. I think probably when all the people rushed to the back, the tail kind of sunk into the water. But then once they got off the airplane, it kind of came back out, because it wasn't that deep in the back and when all the people were gone.
How badly was the underbelly of the airplane damaged? My understanding is that Airbuses use a thinner aluminum than a Boeing aircraft, and I understand some of that ripped off. Is that true?
Well, all I know is what I've seen in the pictures about that, which, you know, anybody could have seen, and frankly, it was a lot more damage than I would have thought, having been there, you know, and you know, living through the impact on the water. I was surprised at how torn up the airplane was.
How old was November 106 U.S.?
Actually, I don't know.
We'll look that up. Now, everyone is rescued. You guys get on shore. All your passengers are safe, and your crew is safe. Where did you go after that?
You know, I don't think they knew what to do with us, because we were probably on that ferry dock for a couple of hours, and there were more police there than passengers and crew. Eight of our passengers actually got off at the ferry dock, went out to the street, hailed a cab back to LaGuardia, and got on the next flight to Charlotte. And but the, surprisingly enough,
yeah.
But the rest of them were just milling about with you know, Red Cross blankets on mostly. And we were probably there for, I'm thinking, a good 2 hours. And then somebody decided that we absolutely had to go to the hospital, even though the only one of the crew that was injured was Doreen, and she was already taken off to the hospital long before then. So we went and checked into a hospital, not checked in, but they came in, they took us our blood pressure, you know, all the vitals to check us in. Then they didn't quite know what to do with us, because nobody was anything but even a little wet. So we sat around there for another couple hours, and then they decided to check us out. So they had to take all of our vitals again, which they just done, because apparently it's a procedure that they have to do at the check-in and the check-out. And Then we went to the hotel, which they had essentially being secluded in so they could stay away from the press.
Was it a nice hotel?
It was a Marriott.
Let's give him a plug. I heard a story that somebody ran into Sully at a cafe drinking a cup of coffee after the incident happened. And by the way, I referred to this as an incident, not an accident, but whatever.
I don't really know anything about that. You know, I mean, a passenger ran into Sully at a...
Not a passenger, just maybe the owner of the cafe, and Sully was sitting there drinking a cup of... We should really call Sully and ask if this actually happened, because a lot of rumors can start. And he was sitting there drinking a cup of coffee and very calm, and as he has been throughout this whole... And you too, and I commend you for that. But I think he was just... If he was, he was just trying to gather his wits and figure out what to do next. But as you said, you had a couple hours, you were sitting there on the shoreline and whatever. Or were you two together for that whole period of time?
Oh, yeah, we were together the whole time.
Well, then it never happened.
I don't know what that would be about, somebody recognizing him in the... I'm assuming that's probably happened at the hotel there, but I don't know that anybody knew who we were at that point.
Well, we all know who you are now, Jeff. Now, as far as officials go, you said the police were there, the rescue people were there. At what point did the pilot union step in, and the FAA and NTSB, and who was first?
Well, the FAA and the NTSB, we don't actually see until we give our testimony. As it turns out, one of the pilot reps for our, we actually have a LaGuardia base, and one of the reps for the LaGuardia base actually lived in Manhattan. So he was probably within 45 minutes of our getting at the ferry dock, he was there and trying to coordinate things with the police. And then by the time we got to the hospital, quite a few people had shown up by that point, because there's standing committees, and whenever anything like this happens, everybody just drops what they do, and they get on a flight to New York City. And by 3 or 4 hours later, there were already, you know, six or seven union representatives, a lawyer, you know, flown up from Charlotte. I was thinking, wow, how'd they get here so fast? But I guess they just got on the next flight and got up there. And by that evening, our accident investigation teams had shown up, and our critical incident response team, which they're basically trained in psychological problems that you might have, you know, after an accident. So they're there to basically tell you, this is what's going to happen to you. When we got to the hotel, they were the first. They spent about 15 minutes with us, and they said, you know, you're not going to sleep tonight. You probably won't sleep tomorrow night. Maybe after that you'll sleep for an hour or two, and then you'll wake up and you'll just relive the whole thing in your mind. You won't be able to turn your mind off. You're going to be exhausted. You know, over time, it will get better. Over time, you might actually remember details that you have forgotten now because your mind has blocked them out. And they're there the whole time we were there, too. If we needed to talk to somebody, they had further meetings with us later, but they're actually trained in this to help you get past, you know, the it's post-traumatic shock is what it is. You know, anytime you're in an accident, that's what you're going to suffer from.
Okay. And did you and Sully and the rest of the crew and the passengers, did you suffer from this post-traumatic syndrome?
I don't know about the passengers, because we really didn't have a lot of contact with them at that point, but all of us did. Nobody slept probably for the first 3 days, you know, that we were there. I know I didn't want to watch TV, and I didn't want to sit around my room, so I was out walking around New York City at 3 and 4 a.m. and, you know, in the winter, just for something to do.
Interesting. You also said that because you didn't want to watch TV, and you know, apparently Sully was the same way?
I don't know if he did or not. I just knew that I didn't want to see anything about it.
Okay, but you were also sequestered, and you're off in a private area, and you just knew that you landed in the Hudson River, but you did know what was going on nationally, apparently.
That's true. We had no idea how this was being perceived. I mean, we're thinking we'd done this horrible thing, and you know, we got this NTSB testimony coming up, and you know, we're suffering from post-traumatic shock. We had no idea how it was being perceived nationally, and you know, some of our you know, union guys, you know, we'd see them down at the restaurant or in the lobby, and they'd say, you know, you have no idea how this is being played out in the press. And of course, my initial reaction was, it must be bad the way they phrase that. And they said, no, they're making heroes out of you guys. And we're like, what? Heroes? We just destroyed an airplane in the Hudson River.
You just saved 155 lives.
Well, I suppose that's true. But, you know, as a pilot, I mean, you're focusing on the fact that, if you didn't get it back to a gate, you just obviously didn't do your full job. And that I think both of us felt that way at the time.
What were some of the questions that the NTSB investigators or the FAA asked you? And who asked you the questions first, FAA or NTSB?
Well, the way it's set up is it's the NTSB's investigation. And they're not, they're not looking to put you in jail. They're looking to find out what happened to prevent it from happening in the future. And they have 8 standing committees. There'll be power plant, operations, human factors. There's a number of them anyways. And they have a main investigator, and he'll just basically get the story from you and maybe ask a few questions. That takes about an hour. And then each committee has one member that is also part of the actual interrogation of us, and they will have a number of questions to ask themselves. And there's also one member of the FAA there. So my testimony took about 2.5 hours, and probably an hour, maybe more of that, was just the main investigator telling the story. And then, for instance, like the human factors person, they say, well, let's start out on the trip. You know, when did you start? You know, how much sleep did you get that night? Did you eat anything? You know, and going through, you know, basically creating a timeline to see if you were, you know, tired or exhausted, or you hadn't eaten anything that day. You know,
stressed out.
To see if that would have any kind of impact on it. And of course, then, you know, the operations people are asking more about, what did you do? You know, okay, you did this checklist. You know, let's go through the checklist. And the FAA person was, they were pretty much asking about the checklist as well. What did you do? Why did you do this? But that's pretty much what it entailed.
Jeff, did you feel uncomfortable during any of these question periods that you had with the FAA and NTSB?
Not really. They know that if it's a confrontational situation, they're not going to get the information that they want. So they try to make it as comfortable as possible. I mean, if they're hanging a light bulb in front of your nose, you know, you're probably not likely to tell them the whole story, for instance. But if it's, you know, and you got to remember that the main goal here is to find out what happened and ensure that it doesn't happen again. It's not that the main goal is to throw you in jail.
Okay, very good. You know, you stated on the David Letterman show that you had a number of engine failures before, and Sully never had one. This is his first time. Did all these engine failures occur while flying an airliner or general aviation aircraft, or was that general aviation aircraft, or what was the nature of each engine failure that you've had in the past?
Well, I guess they probably would all be considered airliners, because my first one was on a piston Convair, and a long, long time ago. And then I had an engine failure on a DC-9 while at US Air, but that was probably 15 years ago. And then here I got 2 in one swoop here on the Airbus, so I guess I got a total of 4.
So your next airplane, you're going to have 4 stars on the fuselage or something?
Yeah, I suppose that's what you'd have. Yeah, maybe 4 propellers.
Oh, yeah, that's what they have. What recommendations or precautions can a pilot or a mechanic take to ensure that they reduce the risk of an engine failure? Obviously, with U.S. Airways, you have top mechanics, and you guys are very experienced pilots, and you're going to do a thorough pre-flight and everything else. But is there any advice you can give your fellow aviation pilots out there, that general aviation pilots or airline pilots, to do to try to avoid an engine failure?
Well, I guess, except for my Convair engine failure, the other ones I wouldn't really say were mechanically related. So, they're like this. I mean, what can you do about hitting geese that are flying along? There's really not much you can do.
Right. You know, birds, my experience has been birds try to avoid aircraft, especially if you have your landing lights on, you had your landing lights on, your strobes and everything else. So maybe they were trying to avoid and whatever, but is that your experience too?
Yeah, oftentimes you'll see them, they dive at the ground when they get close to you. But obviously these birds didn't, or they didn't care.
It was reported in the media that this particular airplane had some engine problems in the past. What do you know about that?
Well, you know, I know what I read in the media, too. I mean, you got to remember, I almost have no more information than you do about this incident, other than I was there when it happened. But the fact that it had a compressor stall the day before, or 2 to 3 days before, I think it was, that was fixed, you know, frankly, you know, using my experience and knowing what goes on, the way I would explain it is, like, let's say your car, you start up your car one day and it's running really rough, so you take it to the shop and they says, well, the one of the spark plugs is you know, the electrode's gone on it, and it's dead. So they replace the spark plug, the car runs fine, you drive it off, 2 days later you get rear-ended at a stop sign. Did the fact that your spark plug was bad 2 days before and was fixed have anything to do with the fact you were rear-ended at the stop sign? No, and then that's really the case here.
Yeah, because the engines were running just fine just before impact with the geese, and so it probably had no relationship whatsoever.
Yeah, they actually, the way they repaired it was they changed a temperature probe, which it was, the engine had a compressor stall apparently, and they changed a temperature probe, which was used by the computers to you know, to determine what the engine speed, you know, what the fuel mixture should be, and they fixed that, and it was running just fine after that.
Okay, very good. How has this experience changed your life and your perspective on life?
Well, I guess it hasn't changed it a lot. I mean, I'm not 25 years old, so, you know, you're pretty much the person you're going to be at this point. Certainly, I've got to do a lot of interesting things in the last month or so that, you know, most people will never have the opportunity to do. But I guess the only thing I take away from it is that, you know, maybe it's a renewed understanding that being an airline pilot is really a pretty serious thing. I mean, it's a serious job for serious people, And I guess, I mean, that's been brought home to me.
How has the incident, again, I call it an incident, not an accident, affected your wife, Barbara, and your children? By the way, how many children do you have and how old are they?
Oh, I have three kids. They're 17, 15, and 12. And, well, they didn't really even know about it until I called them on the phone. So they knew I was okay right from the start. So, I wouldn't say it's really affected them at all, except, you know, my son was a really big man on campus when he got to go to the Super Bowl, you know, and got his picture taken with Adam Sandler. He was flashing that all around school for the next day or two. But no, it really hasn't had any long-term effect on them.
Okay. You know, I met your wife, Barbara, the day after the accident, and she seemed cool, calm, and collective, but very thankful that everything worked out just fine. And that's good. Do you feel that this incident has received too much attention, not enough, or just the right amount?
Oh, way too much attention. I mean, for what it was. I mean, we were surprised it received any attention outside of the industry, and certainly not what it's gotten. I think it's just, I don't know. I don't know what it is, a fluke. You know, people wanted a good news story, and they made it into more than it was. You know, that's all I can really say about it, I guess. It's gotten way too much attention.
Who was it? You probably don't know, but who came up with the title "Miracle on the Hudson"?
Oh, it was the governor of New York City, or not the governor? The governor of New York State. While we were still on the ferry dock, actually, Mayor Bloomberg and he had shown up, and they were doing a press conference, and he coined the term there, and it just sort of took off after that, I guess.
Do you think it's a miracle, or do you think it's more attributed to pilot skill that it turned out all good and safe and wonderful?
You know, what we have said all along is there's a lot of people here who deserve a lot of credit for this. And I'm not just saying Sully and I, but the flight attendants, Sheila, Doreen, and Donna, you know, who they are the ones who actually evacuate the airplane, the passengers themselves, who very orderly lined up, did what they had to do. Nobody was pushing and shoving. Nobody was saying me first. They helped each other out. They deserve as much credit as anybody else. And of course, we would have been nowhere. I mean, this was freezing cold water in the middle of the Hudson River. I mean, we would have been nowhere without all those boats that immediately came to our aid. The captains and crews of those boats and the first responders who met us when we got to the ferry dock. There are a lot of people who deserve a lot of credit for this.
I'm glad to hear you say that. It was really a team effort, and I was very impressed, too, with the boat captains and the crew members and how well trained they were. And they go through training for this sort of thing quite often, but probably not for an airliner, or do they?
Well, not for an airliner, but I found all this out just in the course of this incident, that apparently they actually have to train once a month on in some capacity for pulling people out of the water in just this circumstance.
Fantastic. They're very, very much to be commended. Do you think that people will be talking about Miracle on the Hudson for quite some time, or do you think it's going to be forgotten? Is it going to be just a chapter in history? What's your feeling on that?
Oh, I think it's already pretty much forgotten. Certainly by another week or so it will be. And so, yeah, it'll just be a moment in history. I think, as I've said all along, I think my 15 minutes of fame is just about over here.
And I heard you and Sully mention that that you feel that you were able to handle the situation the way you did because a little part of your, throughout your career, I mean, you have over 20,000 hours of flying time, and Sully has just a little bit less than that, apparently. He has a military background. You have strictly a general aviation background. Isn't that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. And so you have a lot of experience behind you. I mean, 20,000, I can't even imagine ever having 20,000 hours of flying time. But that's because you go to work every day and you hop in the cockpit and you fly all the time. I fly once a week and for business or for pleasure. Now this kind of gets into another area. It's called the age 60 rule, and you're probably quite familiar with that, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we don't have an age 60 rule anymore. We have an age 65 rule now.
Right. And that's a great thing. But because of the experience that was required to handle this situation, as compared with a rookie airline pilot that may have had most of his flight training done on a computer, and then all of a sudden he gets thrown in the right seat, do you feel that it's of benefit to the general public to have people with experience over the age of 60 in that cockpit?
I think that probably people can fly past 60 now more than they can when I was first hired. I know I was always amazed when I was first hired because I was, in my 20s, but my dad was 60 at the time. And I'd look around these guys in the crew room, they're just about to retire, and they look like they were 20 years older than my dad. But I think the life was a lot harder back then. You know, now people, they don't smoke, they don't drink. You know, people just seem to be a lot more aware, and I think they can fly, past 60 more than probably would have been 20 years ago. I guess it would be my hope and belief that anybody who was in the cockpit in our seats would have done pretty much the same thing on that day. You know, we're highly trained professionals. That's what airline pilots are. And I guess I just, like I said, I feel that anybody would have accomplished the same things that we could have done.
Okay, very good. When do you expect to get back flying again?
I'm planning to go back. I'm going to get a couple simulator sessions because I hardly flew the airplane before this, and now it's been 5 weeks. So, but I'm planning to be back flying my trip that goes out mid-March.
Where does U.S. Airways do its sim practice? And I mean, where's the sim flight training center?
They have training centers in Charlotte and in Phoenix, and I work with the Charlotte one.
Jeff, you've been interviewed by Katie Currit, David Letterman, Larry King, and now Midwest Flyer Magazine. What's next on your agenda?
Actually, I have absolutely nothing on my, well, I guess I do. I got to go testify before a congressional subcommittee next Tuesday. So I guess that's pretty big.
Tell me about that testimony. What are you planning on telling them?
At this point, I don't really know what it's going to be about. Apparently, it's just more of a meet the congressman, tell the story a little bit, you know, get pictures taken with us. I mean, obviously, they don't actually make policy at that level. You know, it's the FAA. Well, the FAA is the one that makes all policy. The NTSB can suggest policy, but at that level, they don't. It's not like they're going to mandate two-engine failure training.
Do you know if you're going to be meeting with Representative Jim Oberstar from Minnesota, by chance?
I understand he's part of the committee, and we probably will meet him while we're there.
He's a really good guy, and from what I know of him and what he's done for aviation, general aviation, and the airline industry, you would think the guy was a pilot, but I just found out this year that he's not.
Yeah, I mean, certainly you've heard his name. I mean, I think I've heard his name my entire career. You know, he's been an aviation advocate for obviously decades.
Now, last night you called me and you said that you just met with the Dane County Board here in Madison, Wisconsin, and you met the airport director, Brad Livingston, and you're going to be doing something right after our interview with Brad. Tell us about that.
Well, he asked me to come over, and I think he just wants to introduce me to the firemen there and the airport employees and, you know, the first responders that they have available there at the airport. But I don't really know other than that what exactly it's going to entail.
Well, that should be interesting. Now, there's another invitation that I even have on my list here that you've been invited to EA Air Adventure this summer, July 27th through August 2nd. What do you expect to do during EA Air Adventure?
Well, I have a whole host of activities that Tom Poberesny has set up. One of the things he was mentioning, a new one that he added yesterday, is apparently JetBlue flies an Airbus there for promotional purposes, and he wanted me to basically tell my story in front of the Airbus there. I know what's going to be the high point for me is I kind of hinted that I wouldn't mind getting a ride in a P-51, and he said that I can plan on a ride in a P-51. So that's going to be the highlight of my decade. I can tell you that.
So you suggested or you asked Tom about riding in a P-51, and he said, "Yeah, I'll make it happen."
Yeah, that was pretty much the way it was. In an email, I asked him, I said, you know, is there any chance I could get a ride in a P-51? And he emailed back. He said, plan on a ride in a P-51.
That's great. I'm sure he's looking forward to having you up there, and all the convention guests are going to look forward to it as well. Last question. Where's your Airbus now, and where do you think it will end up?
I have no idea. You know, you emailed me those pictures of it passing through Rutherford, New Jersey, and that's the first I knew that it left wherever site it was. I really know nothing more about what's happened since then than you do.
Well, Jeff, it's been wonderful having you here this morning, and is there anything else that you'd like to add to this interview as far as you're speaking with general aviation pilots? Any final comments?
Yeah, I guess I'd just like to say is that what we've said all along is that, you know, everybody associated did their jobs and it had a positive outcome because of that, directly because of that. Sully and I, flight attendants, passengers, the first responders, the people that came to save us, that's the real story here, is that everybody did their jobs.
And with that, we'll end our conversation with Jeffrey Skiles of Oregon, Wisconsin, U.S. Airways first officer that flew the Airbus 320 November 106 U.S., flight number 1549 on January 15th, 2009, that landed successfully on the Hudson River. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.